up on the tight wire.
I'm in Studio B, and I'm sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alira Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today, we have writing guru, I guess that's a good way to describe her, Natalie Goldberg, whose most famous book, Writing Down the Bones, has been an influential book for many, many writers. And she just came out with a new one called The True Secret of Writing. I want to know that secret. What is it?
We all want to know.
Oh, Ben, you got it. Whatever it is, you know the secret.
I need to go to one of her workshops, I think. You know, Daniel.
Yes.
Right in front of us, we have your new book just arrived in the mail. Hotel Juarez, Stories, Rooms, and Loops. Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, it's been out for about a week now, but I just barely got the copies today because somehow FedEx delivered them to a wrong address. And so they had to go through this office and then this office and this office. I was about to give up, but it's good to finally see it.
It is a wonderful moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you get your book in the mail and you get to hold it in your hands.
It is. You know, I remember my first book, it was Chicano Chicanery. And I remember when I got the first little box of books and I opened it up and I pulled it out. And you know what my first reaction was? It's so thin. It took me 5 years to write and it was a thin book. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is 5 years. But of course, I used to beat myself up and you're teaching me not to do that as a writer.
Well, congratulations. We're very proud of you, Daniel. I'm going to interview you for a future show and I look forward to that.
And I just want to say that the picture, the cover, if you want to Google it, Hotel Juarez, Stories, Rooms, and Loops, and look at that picture, or if you want to buy the book, I took that picture.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's one day you and me and Bobby Bird and a bunch of El Paso activists crossed the border for kind of a march. We did this march for peace, you know, because of all the violence in Juarez. And as we passed by one street, and there was this soldier. And he had these big old, he was hiding behind these big old sandbags, and he was carrying a rifle, and he was like pointing at everybody, and had these dark glasses. I guess he had been stationed there, and it was right next to the Hotel Juarez. And so I snapped a picture of it, of the hotel, that is. Something struck me about the hotel. And you could see the sandbags in front of the hotel, and those are what the soldiers hide behind. So it's a kind of interesting detail. Yeah, I took that picture. So.
Well, and it's real interesting, your book. It's like a loop. I've learned what a loop is. I never knew what a loop was until this book.
I didn't either.
I call them prose poems.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that you structure your book, I get the loop thing.
We'll talk about that some other time. Thanks for mentioning that. And stick around. We have a very, very exciting show. We're going to talk to writing guru Natalie Goldberg, whose new book, The True Secret of Writing, reveals what writers know in their guts.
So stay tuned for more on Words on a Wire. Natalie Goldberg is a poet, painter, teacher, and the author of 12 books, including Writing Down the Bones, Freeing the Writer Within, which has sold more than 1.5 million copies and has been translated into 14 languages. Old Friend from Far Away, The Practice of Writing Memoir, and Wild Mind. She has taught seminars for 35 years to people from around the world and lives in New Mexico. Her latest book is The True Secret of Writing. Welcome to our show, Natalie.
Thank you so much. And you're in El Paso, a place I've always wanted to go to.
Well, you're going to have to come down, and we'll take you into Juarez, to the Kentucky Club, and we'll have some tecates and show you around the plaza. It's a really interesting place.
That sounds terrific.
So let's talk about, Natalie Goldberg, first of all, I got to say that, you know, when I read Writing Down the Bones, I was in graduate school, and it really had an impact on me. And ever since then, I've been, you know, anything I hear by Natalie Goldberg, I have to read. And I just finished reading your latest book, The True Secret of Writing. And what a title.
It's pretty daring, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you use it with any irony at all?
Yes, there's a little irony in it, of course.
But, you know, it actually, it works on many levels because, in essence, you do reveal to writers secrets, and they're true. So they really are true secrets. But also, you're taking the title. It also works on the level of this retreat that you do called True Secrets Retreat in Taos. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, they're silent retreats where we sit, walk, write for a week at a time. And I developed it over the last 12 years. I gave you in writing practice, in writing down the bones, how to do writing practice, but there was a whole world behind it. And that was the life of practice, connecting life with language. It's not only writing. I want you to wake up all the way, all the time when you're drinking a glass of water or chugging down a tecate.
Well, you know, you said sit, walk, and write. Sounds like the holy trinity of the creative process. Can you talk about the importance of sitting and then walking, which is one of my favorite subjects?
Yeah. Well, with sitting, obviously I mean meditation, but sitting is watching your mind, just not moving, and watching your, feeling your breath go in and out. That's how you anchor yourself. And you just watch your mind, and you keep coming back to your breath. And one of the things you learn that I didn't know till I tried to sit still is my mind wanders all the time.
Mm.
So in sitting still, you get a relationship with your mind. And really, what is the most important tool of a writer? The human mind. So the more you have a relationship with it, the better you can use it as a tool. So that's number one. And number two, really, and the other thing that we do all the time is walking. The rhythm of walking, the movement of our body, and it's connected to our mind and our heart and our breath and the words that come out. It's all really interconnected. You know, they're not separate. And I think one of the things in our society, we've separated it so you can write something great and not take in that knowledge yourself. So we know so many people, we've read books that have made us so happy, and the author either is an alcoholic or commits suicide. So this is where the training comes in, so that you get, the writer themselves not only gets to write, but gets to also digest the their own awake mind, so it can feed their life and not just the reader's life. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it makes
absolutely.
Sense. You know, your philosophy of writing is so much like a religion.
Yeah.
Like Zen, in
yes.
fact.
Yes, it is Zen.
Yes.
It's really Zen, but it's what Zen is for everyone. It doesn't matter what religion you are. You know, I was brought up Jewish. You can still do Zen. It's like doing yoga.
Mm-hmm.
You can be, you know, you'd be a more flexible Catholic.
Right.
So physically flexible Catholic. So this is a practice really before religion.
Right. It's spiritual. And I think that even the creative process itself, whether you're writing poetry or fiction or music, oftentimes leads you to the same type of mystical experiences of, say, St. Teresa de Avila or other mystics. You kind of, I won't say see beyond the veil, but a little bit. You get glimpses into, you know, into something that exists not necessarily in time-space.
Exactly, because mostly we live in discursive thinking, which is a very thin layer at the top of the water. And when you write, you dive under to how you really see, think, and feel, and how the mind really works, and an intimacy with all life. And that's really spiritual. And I think a lot of people, when they read Writing Down the Bones, came to me, not because they wanted to be Faulkner or Hemingway, but because they wanted to connect with themselves and had a religious, spiritual longing, but they weren't interested in institutional religion.
That makes sense. You know, you say something that seems paradoxical to me, and maybe it is a paradox, about getting out of the way.
Yes.
To get out of the way to discover your own obsessions. That seems really paradoxical to me. So can you talk about that?
Well, in a way, we're run by our obsessions. But when you write about them, you can see what, and you reread it later, you can see what they are. And in a way, if you get out of the way and let writing do writing, you even express them more clearly. So they really glow off the page. And then you get to see them. And then you get to use that energy for writing. And in a way, you turn those obsessions, which sometimes can reduce your life, into a passion, which opens up your life.
So in other words, you're saying that if we get out of the way, that's the only way to gain control and insight into our own work.
Yeah, but we never gain control. But we get to see it. We get to see who we are, and it's sort of almost mind reflecting mind.
And if we're lucky enough, we could submit to it as opposed to control it.
Yeah, and just let go.
We're talking to Natalie Goldberg, whose latest book is called The True Secret of Writing, and what writer wouldn't want to know that secret? And you were talking a couple of times just now about letting the mind wander, and I'm wondering, or the mind going here and the mind going there, and it sounds a little bit like your concept of the wild mind, of reaching the wild mind. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, you know, wild mind, people think it means the mind is acting out and running all over the place and going crazy. But really what wild mind is, it's sort of the difference between, you know, how we plant beautiful little gardens with peonies and stuff in the summer, and yet long to be out in nature where there's it's seemingly no order, and yet we feel relief and can actually deeply relax. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true with the mind, too. We try to order it and control everything and live in that discursive thinking. I have to pay my bill. I don't like this. I've got to pick up some mayonnaise. I have to do this. So-and-so doesn't like me, blah, blah, blah. And that's discursive thinking. And then when you drop down underneath, it's wild mind. Wild mind is connected with everything.
Mm. It sounds a little bit like Clarissa Pinkola Estes's idea of the Rio Bajo el Rio in her book on the wild woman archetype, to reach that.
Yes, I think that's true. Yes, I know Clarissa. I love her, and I think she's on to something.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just a different way of articulating arriving at the wild mind or the Rio Bajo el Rio.
Does discursive thinking have anything at all to do with writing? Anything?
Oh, yes. Discursive thinking you need to know, have a relationship with. We do have a relationship, but unfortunately we follow it and listen to it as though it were God. And part of discursive thinking is this little mechanism in our brain that I call monkey mind, but you might call the critic.
Monkey mind, that's great.
That is constantly commenting, oh, I think I'm going to write. No, you can't write. Who do you think you are?
Right.
You're not good enough to write. You can't say those things. That isn't nice. So you have to have a relationship with that part of yourself so you don't let it run your life. And unfortunately, I meet lots of people, it runs their life. They have a deep desire to write, but they can't do it because monkey mind is so loud.
Mm. This reminds me of a passage in your book. You're talking about a woman who's having a hard time. Her husband might be cheating on her. Her daughter might be smoking pot. And she's just really not handling it very well. But then one day you see her, and she has this piece about her. And you say, what happened? And she says, well, I'm writing. And writing feels too good to let other things get in the way.
Exactly. Yeah. It kind of orders your life, you know. Okay, so the whole world is collapsing, but you just wrote a beautiful sentence, and it feels good. The reason I kept writing was in, 1972 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I sat down and wrote a real poem, you know, where I really trusted my mind and didn't worry if it made sense or not. And I never felt so good and whole before. I tasted something completely outside my usual experience, and I just followed it.
It's really difficult sometimes to write. And for me, it seems like breathing, because I write all the time. I feel as if when I'm not writing, my world is falling apart. Not the world, but my but my world.
Yes.
And because that's the way I ordered my world, and I have this exercise I gave to myself and I give to other people to write a sentence a day. And it reminds me of you saying get out of the way, because you write a sentence a day, have a folder, and then when you read all of those sentences and dates in a row, you realize how revealing it is about you.
Yeah, and do you ask them to rework the sentence, or it just has to go down?
No, right. Just write the sentence for
exactly.
The day.
Exactly. Hmm. That's great. That's what's called a practice, and that's what I talk about in The True Secret of Writing, about having a practice, not good or bad, just show up and do it.
You also talk about this concept, no place is heaven, every place is heaven, and this really strikes me because I hear a lot of writers kind of say they use an excuse sometimes of not being able to write because of where they're at. There's nothing exciting about it. And that's just not true. I mean, any place can be heaven. Any place can be hell. And I think of me, I travel a lot, you know, and I write. I don't write about the travels necessarily, but I write while I'm traveling. And Ben doesn't, he stays home and he writes. And he writes brilliant books. Like I said, one just won the Penn Faulkner Award. And I travel, and maybe my writing isn't as brilliant, but it's just, it doesn't matter, right?
No, it doesn't. What matters is that you stay connected to it and you continue that relationship, because that's what you want to do, even when it's really hard. And that's another secret of writing, which I think I don't mention. It's hard.
Well, there is the thing of discipline and desire.
Yeah. How do you actualize your desire? You have to practice. Mm. You have to show up regularly. And suddenly the desire, you don't want it. You know, I don't think I want this anymore. Well, you have to shut up. You said you wanted it. Follow through.
And you say to people who have full-time jobs and use that as an excuse not to write, you say use your weariness after work to write. Can you
yes.
tell us about that?
Yeah, because you're already broken down. So the editor doesn't have as much energy to tell you they hate you. So you just kind of sit down, collapse, and just let it flow.
And you advise to just take whatever time that you have, you know, make time. And it makes me think of Frank O'Hara's lunchtime poems. I mean, here he worked full-time, but he'd be walking the streets of New York City at lunchtime and writing down poems.
Yes, and William Carlos Williams, who was a children's doctor, and between patients, he'd write a little poem on the prescription pad.
And Faulkner writing in, where did he work?
The post office. The post
yeah. Office. Yeah. I mean, you can just fit it in. I knew, what's his name, who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
He wrote at 3 in the morning. He had a full-time job. He'd come home and go to sleep and wake up at 3 in the morning and write.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, I always tell my students, writers write.
Yeah.
They don't complain about not having time to write. They write.
Yes, it's a wonderful way of putting it.
We've been talking to Natalie Goldberg, author of Writing Down the Bones and her latest book, The True Secret of Writing. Thank you so much for being on Words on a Wire, Natalie.
Oh, this was so much fun. I love the both of you.
For this week's Poem of the Week, I am going to read Ave Maria by Frank O'Hara. It is one of his lunchtime poems, his lunch poems that he used to write during his lunchtime in New York City. I'm dedicating this to Natalie Goldberg because she says, use your weariness after work to write. And I suppose that means even during lunch. So, Ave Maria by Frank O'Hara. Mothers of America, let your kids go to the movies. Get them out of the house so they won't know what you're up to. It's true that fresh air is good for the body, but what about the soul that grows in darkness, embossed by silvery images? And when you grow old, as grow old you must, they won't hate you. They won't criticize you. They won't know they'll be in some glamorous country they first saw on a Saturday afternoon or playing hooky. They may even be grateful to you for their first sexual experience, which only cost you a quarter and didn't upset the peaceful home. They will know where candy bars come from and gratuitous bags of popcorn, as gratuitous as leaving the movie before it's over, with a pleasant stranger whose apartment is in the Heaven on Earth building near the Williamsburg Bridge. Oh, mothers, you will have made the little tykes so happy, because if nobody does pick them up in the movies, they won't know the difference. And if somebody does it, it'll be sheer gravy. And they'll have been truly entertained either way, instead of hanging around the yard or up in their room hating you prematurely, since you won't have done anything horribly mean yet, except keeping them from the darker joys. It's unforgivable, the latter, so don't blame me if you won't take this advice and the family breaks up and your children grow old and blind in front of a TV set, seeing movies you wouldn't let them see when they were young. That was Ave Maria by Frank O'Hara.
And that was a wonderful poem.
My name is John Niels, and I'm an MFA candidate here at the University of Texas at El Paso. My poetic license is about my experience being a bilingual writer, speaker, and reader. The following essay that I'm going to read from is about my experience and how being bilingual has affected my poetics. The name of the essay is Cacography. When I was a boy, around 12 years old, I drew out a treasure map for my little sister. A reasonable approximation, I thought, of the open space that lay behind our house. The parking lot, the path, a small creek, a straggle of cottonwoods, and on the edge of the map, Stanley Lake off in the distance. Maybe a sea serpent swam on the map, a skull and crossbones marking dangers, and a treasure chest with an X marking the spot. Perhaps I dated the map, and if so, the date would have preceded the arrival of the white man to the Colorado Front Range. When I finished, I aged it, crumpled it, burnt the edges, dipped it in water, and convinced my sister there was a treasure to be found. I ask myself now, why I drew up that map? Because it was funny? Because if I got my sister to believe in the map, I could make her believe anything? Battlefields, massacres, burial sites? I was a great explorer. I would have power, control over how she perceived the world. Deep down, I wanted to make her submit to my vision. A map is an approximation of the land, meant to guide you. Through a map, you can project yourself out into the world. Within its charted framework, towns, cities, the roads and highways that connect them, the spaces in between, vast uncharted wilderness, omissions, become somehow filled spaces, comprehended all at once. The whole world mapped out. There is no going off into the unknown. It's right there on the map. But there exist dimensions not labeled on any maps. Entire worlds found in the uncharted spaces in between. Growing up, I tacitly accepted the maps provided by the cultural constructions of the American imaginary. Languages and cultures packaged for easy consumption, vast complexities glossed over and obscured. Being bilingual, I've entered into these dimensions in a way I never could before. I've developed a greater appreciation for the many-voicedness that makes up our world. In struggling to express myself in Spanish, I've come to recognize the limits of representation from one language and culture to another, and how we tend to fence the world based on crude simplifications. In such reductionist attitudes, I hear the rap on Gloria Anzaldúa's knuckles upon unleashing her wild tongue. All forced to be of one mind, one language, one action, to play out the cultural narrative, fulfilling expectations, out of many one, or rather not any, but one. I see narrative texts as a sort of map. A world is created, privileging certain elements of the narrative world over others, creating certain meaning and resonance. What seems a fully realized world is, as any map, full of uncharted wilderness, and the reader is charged with filling in those empty spaces. As such, the writer has a responsibility to create a world. Not the world the reader has come to expect, but a world that approaches the complexities of reality. Though I didn't grow up with the struggle of navigating a forking identity, of being stuck between two worlds, of having my language and culture attacked and dismissed. Being bilingual, I have experienced a feeling of dissociation, of being unable to reconcile my experiences in Spanish and English, as if these two worlds were incompatible, as if they couldn't coexist in one person at the same time. There is a mutual suspicion of each language, that somehow, covertly, language works as a colonizing force claiming territories. I think this stems from a sense of betrayal, each language and culture wanting to claim their loyalties. For my part, I've done little to tie down the mobile borders between English and Spanish, inviting each to enter in where they will. In my own writing, I allow this lingual dissonance to exist. I often code-switch between English and Spanish. Rather than contextualizing the Spanish with italics or explanatory phrases, I want to make it clear another language is being spoken. By privileging Spanish alongside English, with no markings or explanations, with no apologies, the reader is forced to reconcile the two languages. By code-switching, I don't intend to give a sense of the exotic, but of the mundane, of another dimension outside of English, surrounded by English, present alongside and in, a datum from which millions of people experience the world. The monolingual reader must admit a depth to the characters who don't speak their own language. Seeing their words is like seeing the person, on their terms, not as the other would have it. Those many years ago, I went out into those fields with map in hand. My map created a reality, a history I could tap to manipulate my sister. The cultural constructions of languages and cultures work this way, playing on a sense of loyalty, of assumed superiority, and stigmatizing the subaltern, squelching the many-voicedness of those who do not speak as they would have it. Now, I feel the maps I followed were a ruse, a way of charting mobile borders, of signifying what is everywhere escaping. For me, it is a simple recognition of fact. There are other people who exist, in other ways, and no matter how much we'd all like to map out their identities, their trajectories refuse to be pinned down like a destination on a map.
Thank you, Jonathan Nels, for this week's Poetic License. We'd like to thank you for listening in to another edition of Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sines.
Don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubberneck giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre.